Well, it's Monday night somewhere, so this must be Mintcast. Welcome to Mintcast episode 144. I should have looked up what that was in octal before I did that. But anyway, episode 144, recorded live on January the 14th for release, well, yes, sometime later. 2, 3, 4 days, something like that. I'm Rob, and with me on the podcast this week, of course, is my good buddy Scott, my brother from another mother. How are you doing, Scott? What have you been up to? That ought to give you lots of material to get started on.
There you go, but I was actually stunned for a second there. So I stunned into
it was
silence.
So good. I knocked them flat.
Well, like we were saying in the pre-show, we have more than one listener who confuses our voices anyways now that James isn't here. So maybe we are maybe it's not from another mother. Maybe it's the same one. Who knows?
Or maybe it's just we're brother humans.
I don't know.
You know, what do you figure, Scott, is the closest we've physically ever been together?
I was in Louisiana.
Okay.
So probably when I was in Shreveport.
You were probably in Shreveport, and I was down here in the great state of Texas. So that's probably the closest we've ever been. And likely the same for most of our relatives. So I think the claim that we're brothers is on shaky ground.
Shaky ground. Indeed, and I would say the secret decoder for telling us apart is Rob is the one with the Canadian accent.
So, no, I don't have an accent. You've got a touch of a Midwest type accent, but I have no accent.
Not at all.
No, it doesn't hardly ever come out.
Well, you know what, Rob? We probably shouldn't waste time.
True, because we got a lot of stuff that you did say that we had a lot of stuff to cover tonight. So let's get into
stuff.
It.
A ton of stuff.
So let's see what's been up. What's been going on this week? Well, I can't remember. I'm getting old and can't remember stuff that's been going on. I worked all week, it seems to me, and we're back at that again this week. And did a bunch of looking at. Well, we'll tease it a little bit. We're going to look at some command line utilities later on in the show. So you want to stick around for three very, very powerful command line utilities that you probably have all used at least a little bit. And if you're like me, you've wondered, now, is this all these things can do? Well, we're here with the goods on it, and we have not left it at the simple level. So we got lots and lots of details on how to use these things. But that's later in the podcast. So I spent some time doing that. Spent some time, of course, playing DDO. Spent some time monkeying with my Raspberry Pi. It has comfortably been running nonstop for a couple of weeks now. I was kind of just burning it in, and I'm talking to it from my through over SSH from my offhand Linux box here. And Bill MI in the chat was wagering if I was still running XFCE. And yep, that's what it's still running. It has not been rebooted in 20 days now. So it's perking along very nicely. And that's how I'm communicating with the Pi. So that's all working out all right. So that's what I've been up to. How about you, Scott? What have you been doing?
Oh, that's very cool. So to get to the thing that people are wondering right off, and Bill was wondering, was wagering. So we've got some off-site side betting going on here.
Side bet wagers going on in the pre-show.
Yeah, it's hard to define what using KDE means. He had asked, is Scott still using KDE? It is actually still on the laptop that I installed it on. I was in there just the other day using it because I was looking at a Caligra plan, and I looked to what it would take to download and install that on my Cinnamon box, and there was all sorts of dependencies that were going to come down with it. When I looked at my KDE box, it was like two packages, because obviously most of the base files are already there. And so I actually loaded that on there, and I'm probably going to be taking a closer look at the Caligra plan to see if it's a tool that has any kind of functionality that is good. I use Microsoft Office Project at work quite a bit, and I was interested in seeing if I could find a good open source alternative, and so looked at that. So the answer, I guess, is yes. And is it my daily machine? No. So there's your KDE
story. Using it. Yeah,
but I'm still using it. Yeah.
And I hear rumors of Pi efforts on your behalf this week as well.
Yeah, if you're out there on Google Plus, if you're in the Mintcast community, I just posted in the regular community. I can't remember where I put it, but I actually managed to get XBMC running on my Pi and outputting to my TV, and it was remarkably easy, and it looks fantastic. And it I played a couple of movies through it with absolutely no issue, no lag, no artifacts in there. And this is, you know, coming out of the Pi at, I couldn't tell you what the resolution was exactly, but I mean, I'm running it on a 50-inch plasma. It looked gorgeous.
So it's
it was
full
great.
It blows out at full HD, as far as I know.
Yes, it does.
Yeah,
it does.
So and that's 1920 by 1080. So
yeah, the configuration was really simple, and I was really impressed. I'm waiting on a keyboard remote. Motorola actually makes it. And on one side, it's made for the XBMC. On one side, it's a standard remote. On the flip side, it's got a QWERTY keyboard, and that you can do.
Cool.
You know, it's got the little wireless piece. And there's actually a website that I used as a reference called My Media Experience. And on there, he's got what he titles as the only XBMC for Raspberry Pi guide you'll ever need. And he talks about this remote as well as some others. And so I'm going to give it a shot. And at that point, I'm going to hook it up to at least one of my TVs and leave it hooked up for the time being because of it's just got great functionality. So,
cool. And are you using it to stream stuff off the internet, or are you playing local content?
I have set it up to do some streaming. I haven't tested that enough yet to really get a good feel. And to be honest, I actually went out and looked at a few of the. They were standard channels that came default with the and it's the RaspBMC distro that I was using. I looked at OpenELEC or OpenELEC, but decided if RaspBMC was going to work, I would just go with that. So but lots of options, lots of stuff to play with. I actually had intended to get into some of the advanced features, maybe even see if I could get torrenting and some other things set up on it this weekend, and just ran out of time. Was actually engrossed in working on our main topic this weekend, spent quite a bit of time. And one of the nice things is I have a little case study that relates to the utilities that we're going to be talking about. So that should be fun. We're going to get into that in just a bit here.
All right. Well, this looks like it's going to be an action-packed episode indeed. And just before we get into the news here, I wanted to just point out for those of you that are following the Google Plus Community Scorecard, as of the podcast, 5:22 p.m., the Mintcast community has 130 members. The Going Linux podcast has 129 members. And
we rock.
We do. You know, we're just blowing them out of the water. We're so far ahead, we can hardly see them back there. So it's a challenge to all you Going Linux podcast users to get out there and support your community and join up, because really, you're behind us? Come on. I've been looking up to you for years.
Well, and I think Russ actually let the cat out of the bag in somewhere on Google Plus.
Oh, he didn't.
Yeah, and
we're going to get smoked.
Mr. Bushy is on to the game now.
This is going to be a problem. Yeah. This is going to be a problem. We're going to get run over here very shortly.
We probably will. As soon as he makes the announcement, it's over. So
we're done. Yeah, as soon as he calls in the army, they'll be going to 500 in the heartbeat.
Yeah.
Anyways, we should probably go look at some news, I guess. So, Scott, why don't you start us off with this Canadian story, since you're actually the closest one to Canada.
There you go, even though you've got the accent.
I got the accent, but you got, you know, geographic chops, so you could be there faster than I could.
Well, and I actually read the story, too, so that helps.
Well, there's that. I didn't want to say that. Come on, give me a break here.
You know, we're always talking about different civil governments taking up open source mainly it's like, oh, they're going to put, open source desktops in or things along these lines. Well, this story coming out of Canada is that developers who work actually for the Treasury Board of Canada, which oversees Canada's federal civil service, have come up with a open source hit. And what this is they've put together, I'm trying to find the description of it again. It's the acronym is WET, WET, and it's actually
Web Experience Toolkit.
Yeah, and so this has become popular to the point where, oh, there it is, yep, a set of open source tools that the Treasury Board uses for building websites. And this toolkit has become popular to the point where they've been able to host a sort of a hackfest. And it's interesting, the article talks about the fact that the hackfest that they had for this was more like something that you would see, it didn't seem like a gathering of government officials and such. It's sort of a rare in that space, but more like just a normal hackfest where you see, like a maker fest or something to that effect. And it's sort of a surprise that this thing has had this kind of popularity and it's being adopted. And they're looking to push it even further and to sort of continue to develop it. And this sort of shared development, the open source model, has been very effective in furthering the development of this and then therefore benefiting the originators of it, this Treasury Board of Canada. So it's sort of an interesting thing, interesting story. It actually was written up in Wired. And so we'll have a link in the show notes. You can go and check that out. This is just another way, I think, that open source is making inroads in different government entities. It's not just, hey, we're going to replace your desktops. We're going to, we're taking away Windows and giving you Linux. It's different ways that that they can show success for open source projects.
And so most of these stories that we've covered in the past have been European.
Yes.
Is this and we made kind of the comment that, oh, well, North Americans are kind of, well, Americans is the way we put it, are way behind. Our government's not going to pick this up at all. So it's interesting that this is a North American kind of phenomenon that we're seeing here. I wonder if there's anything equivalent in the States here.
Yeah, and there's actually some references to entities here in the States who are adopting this Web Experience Toolkit. But it'd be interesting to know. I don't know if the stories don't come out. Or if we just don't hear about them, or if there's other projects like you say like this that are in the U.S. versus just in Canada. But I thought this was great in the sense that there is, whether it doesn't necessarily always have to be the big story that Yep. your government's dumping Microsoft for open source, but that there's projects like this that are out there, and I imagine there are more that are follow the similar model. But this one's actually gained such popularity that they can do things like hold a hack fest.
Yeah, cool. Interesting.
All right. Oh, geez, I got the next story too. Sorry, folks.
You got the cow.
Yeah, the next one's just a quick story and a follow-up on what we talked about last week. So there was a go-no-go meeting by the Fedora team on the 2nd of January, and they decided that even though there's still some major bugs that the team, at that point they decided they weren't going to release it, and this is a story we ran last week. Well, again, last week in the aftermath of our podcast, they held another go-no-go meeting and decided that those bugs have been squashed to the point where they can go ahead and release. And very likely by the time you're hearing this podcast, unless you're here with us on the live stream, you'll be able to go out to the Fedora site and download Fedora 18 Spherical Cow. That's actually going to get released tomorrow, January 15th. So that's a good thing. It's good that they get that out there. And we'll take a look at it. I don't know that we'll give it a full review unless we hear from our people that say they want that. But, as we talked about in the past, Fedora has always been a good distribution for pioneering the use of different technologies that have seemed to make their way down into other distros like Ubuntu, Debian, and such. And so, I think that it's important that they are able to release, and hopefully it's a very successful distro for them.
Yeah, and I hope, as I said the last time we talked about this, I hope this isn't a sign of them sort of backing away from being a cutting-edge distro and wanting to only release when it's fully completed, because that I think flies in the face of what Fedora was originally intended to be. So speaking of things that are releasing, well, that's a little bit of a weak idea, but anyway, this next story is about Lego goes Linux. And there's a couple of aspects to this story. The straight up story is, and this is an article that we'll link to from Internet News that says it's from the What Else Would They Use files. Move over Raspberry Pi and Arduino. there's a new maker on the block. I've been lusting after Arduino and Raspberry Pi based maker initiatives since I first heard about them. Plug and play, build your own electronics with Linux and open source goodness. It's just like Lego, people kept telling me. Well, he says, finally, or funny how thing, how times change. Now, Lego is set to embrace Linux in a limited way. So the new Mindstorms EV3 robot playset will include Linux-based firmware. And so what that means is it's not all based on Linux, and it's not, you know, they haven't switched over to Linux completely. But Linux skills are going to be part of this work with Lego, and so you can they'll be able to use Lego and Linux skills and teach them all together. So, so it doesn't replace kind of a dedicated robotics platform, but it's complementary to things that people are doing with Arduinos and with the Raspberry Pi. And in fact, and I don't see it in the article here, but it seems to me that I read something just recently about an interface that was that people were putting together to let your Raspberry Pi drive one of these new Lego Mindstorms tools. Some of the comments are not quite as positive as this, but still, I think it's a move in the right direction. I think Lego is looking at this and seeing the synergy between what they're trying to do with the Mindstorms robot platform and what people are actually doing with Arduinos and with the Raspberry Pi particularly. And they're seeing, oh, yeah, okay, Linux makes some sense here for us to be working together or embedding in our stuff. So it's nice to see them going in this kind of direction. It was kind of fun to read that. That this is one of the kinds of things that I've been toying with, looking at for what to do. The project that I want to do with the Pi that I've got is to use the GPIO pins and connect it up either to an Arduino that would drive some motors or to a webcam that I could use for, you know, face tracking and things like that. So lots of interesting little hacks, and it's nice to see Lego in the middle of this. My Pi sits in a Lego box here on my desk beside me. So neat story. Yeah.
Well, when I read this story, I thought that's just a natural marriage. You could, you know, as somebody who doesn't have any Legos in this house, but played with them a lot when I was younger, it just seems like, you know, almost like what took you guys so long to get to this place.
Yeah.
So,
well, the notion that they would wire up the Mindstorms robot system to a Linux system or to one of these small single board computers is the kind of, well, why didn't they do this already? One of the comments points out that you actually can't, the software development for the Mindstorms doesn't run on Linux. Mm. And so that has been maybe even one of the more problematic areas. So they've embedded down in the firmware in the EV1 is based on around Linux now. But the programming tool, the thing that you develop Mindstorm programs in, apparently still does not yet run on Linux. Haven't looked to see if it runs under Wine or how to make it work, but Anyway, interesting story.
So our next story is sort of from the odds and ends department, and this is that IBM. So IBM has their supercomputer Watson. You guys may recall that Watson was the computer that went on Jeopardy and won lots of money. And their story came out that Watson had to undergo brainwashing to sort of forget all the naughty words that it was taught from the Urban Dictionary. So the story goes that a couple of years ago, this is actually two-year-old information. It's just coming to light this week, or it was widely reported this week. 2 years ago, one of the Watson programmers attempted to teach the computer the Urban Dictionary. If you're not aware what the Urban Dictionary is, you can Google it, and don't be at work.
Probably NSFW, not safe for work. Not good, yeah.
Yeah, but it contains definitions for all sorts of terms, ranging from internet abbreviations and texting abbreviations like LOL or OMG to slang such as hot mess. But the problem sort of arose when they realized that Watson could not make the determination, could not distinguish between polite language and profanity. And of course, there is lots of profanity in the Urban Dictionary. So there, it says here that Watson picked up some bad habits from reading Wikipedia as well. In tests, it even used the word, and we're going to just abbreviate to BS, in an answer to a researcher's query. So they actually went in and scraped Watson's memory. They did a little Sunshine of the Eternal Mind, or what was that movie? They
rinsed his digital mouth out with soap, I think.
Yes, they did, right? And scraped his memory. And so Watson, the story actually, the headline that we'll link to, it says, a researcher feeds Watson supercomputer Urban Dictionary, very quickly regrets it. So I thought that was a, you know, this has been fairly widely reported because, but again,
it's a hilarious story.
Yeah, and Watson runs SUSE, is my understanding, a version of SUSE Linux. So,
oh, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, you know, maybe that's one for your.
I'll feed the pie
the Urban Dictionary,
yeah. and we'll just trash talking pie.
We'll bring it on the show and see how many times we have to break out the badger.
Hey, that's good. Yeah, it could replace me. That'd probably be a real improvement in the quality of the discussion.
Yeah, we'll bring it on the show, and we'll program our Mindshare Lego robot to hit the badger button.
Hit the badger button
and see
just
if it,
ahead
can,
of the Urban Dictionary.
See if we can get it all to work. Yeah. Yeah.
So continuing on in our ever decreasing spiral of downward news, this next one is up there with us in hilarity with that one. The news is entitled White House Responds to Death Star Petition: Obama Does Not Support Blowing Up Planets. So this is a testament to the folly and the flexibility, I think, of the American style of government. The U.S. has this deal on the We the People petitioning system. So anyway, through that, the America's Netzians have demanded that President Obama consider building the legendary Star Wars Death Star. So that's odd enough. The interesting thing is that the White House actually responded to this. So unsurprisingly, they have thoughtfully rejected the request, claiming that it would cost an estimated $850 and what is that? Billion,
I think it's quadrillion.
Well, it depends on whether you're using the British system or the American system, but it's 3, 6, 9, 12, 50, 850 times 10 to the 15th dollars. So it's going to cost
a lot of bucks.
Yeah, we would have to pay off the debt several times on installments in order to be able to include that. And not only that, the administration does not support blowing up planets. The White House was forced to offer an official response to arguably the silliest question in American history, since the petition garnered the requisite 250,000 signatures on the We the People petitioning system. So I think this is hilarious that they only responded after there was a groundswell of media attention because they hadn't responded yet.
Yeah, so a couple of things with the We the People. If you get more than 25,000 signatures on any kind of petition on We the People, the White House says they will at the very least respond to the petition. So some of the other things that have been in the news, gun control opponents wanted to deport Piers Morgan because he was taking an anti-gun or a pro-gun control stance, and they weren't happy about it. You know, these are things, and they got enough signatures. The White House had to respond. They said, "Nah, we're not going to do that. We believe in the First Amendment and the Second Amendment." So,
yeah.
things like that. So because they got more than 25,000 signatures on this, the White House had to respond in some form or fashion. Now, they could have just come out and said, "Denied. We're not going to do that." If we're going to have a link in the show notes, if you have not read
to
this,
the We the People site, this is
you're absolutely right.
The
so
We the People site,
it's actually petitions.whitehouse.gov, and the response that they put out there. And they actually even titled it, "This isn't the petition response you're looking for." So
this
the
isn't
guy,
the petition response you're looking for.
Yeah, the guy who wrote it, it's awesome. The references that he makes throughout, you know, the best one was, why would we spend 850 whatever kajillion dollars building a Death Star that has a fatal flaw that can be exploited by a single fighter?
So he's actually seen the movies.
Yes, and if you haven't read the response, click on the show notes, go out and read it. It's hilarious. It's really well done.
We don't have a Death Star, but we do have floating robot assistants on the space station, a president who knows his way around a lightsaber, and advanced marshmallow cannon.
They just did a great job in terms of not only with the references to Star Wars and the whole Star Wars phenomena, but in using the opportunity to talk about things that we are doing and things that are happening out there. So I think they really did. And it was written by one of the scientists. It says down at the bottom of the response who wrote it, but it just, I thought it was it's like a masterstroke. It really is well done. And it's been very widely covered in the news. It's all over the place, this response. But I just wanted to talk about it because I really thought it was really well. Even my wife appreciated it. She thought it was hilarious. Yeah. And she's not a Star Wars fan.
So good press in, arguably a month or two where the government hadn't done much that deserves good press.
Yeah.
So that's a good one, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to wrap us up for our news. And since we've got this this great detailed command line session coming up, I think we ought to probably move into the main topic here. So when you start talking about command line, people have one of two reactions. They either get real antsy and don't want to talk about it. It's just too hard. We just don't want to get into this. Or they go kind of uber geek on you, and they're typing these great long commands out that do amazing things. And so we wanted to take a look at two or three utilities that are amazingly useful little tools on the command line. And so those utilities are grep, sed, and awk. And so these are all text processing kinds of utilities, and both grep and awk are based on regular expressions. And so I thought I'd spend a little bit of time just talking about regular expressions, because I knew about regular expressions, and probably anybody who's been around Linux a little while has encountered regular expressions. For me, it's just always been sort of a bizarre arcanity. You look at it and you think, yeah, that probably means something, but I don't know, I can't figure it out. Well, and so it turns out that regular expressions are not really very complicated. There's a lot of intricate little details to them, but it's a relatively straightforward idea. And it fits into these three particular command line utilities, because grep, sed, and awk are all fundamentally text processing tools. You can use regular expressions with them. So I did some skulking about on the web, of course, went to my standard source for all wisdom, Wikipedia, to find out what exactly is a regular expression. Well, Wikipedia says, in computing, a regular expression is a specific pattern that provides concise and flexible means to match, specify, and recognize strings of text, such as particular characters, words, or patterns of characters. And then there's some common abbreviations. And so regular expressions are used by many text editors, utilities, or programming languages to search and manipulate text based on patterns. And so grep is a utility. Awk is more of a programming language than it's a utility. More to it. So I'm going to talk, there's more to it than there is to grep. So I'm going to talk a little bit about regular expressions and then tell you a little bit about grep. So some basic ideas around regular expressions. Okay, so a regular expression, the simplest regular expression is just a string of symbols to match as is. So in other words, if you were wanting to build a regular expression that was M-I-N-T, well, that would be a pattern that would match those four characters all together. So it would only match M-I-N-T. So the power of regular expressions comes in because they have some other special characters. And so the first class of these are quantifiers. So that lets you match more than one character. In other words, so my M-I-N-T, so if I wanted to match M-I-N-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T, then I could use M-I-N-T and then the plus sign, because plus means match one or more of the whatever came before it. If I wanted to match M-I-N-T followed by anything, because I want to catch Mint 14 and Mint Cast and all of that, I could do M-I-N-T star. So I can match any number from 0 to infinity with the asterisk. Question mark matches 0 or more. And then there are some more complicated ways of doing that kind of matching as well, using curly braces to match exactly some number of occurrences, or at least this many but not more than that many occurrences. So some more fancy ways to do it. So that's the simplest way to use, or the first kind of quantifying multiple characters. There are a bunch of special characters that are used to match things that maybe are not so obvious how you would do it. Like the dot matches any single character. So one of anything. You can just put a dot that says, okay, anything goes in there. Backslash N will match a new line. Backslash T matches a tab. Backslash lowercase d will match any digit, so 0 through 9. Backslash uppercase D matches a non-digit, so anything except 0 through 9. And the same thing, W, lowercase matches a character, uppercase matches a an alphanumeric character, uppercase matches a non-alphanumeric, S matches white space. Then you can escape characters, and that means, well, so what if I want to match a backslash? Well, I put a backslash and then a backsplash, and that matches both of them. The caret, which is on a standard US keyboard, is the shift 6, so the little up arrow caret character, that matches the beginning of, so begins matches only things at the beginning of a stream. Of the input string, and so somebody's going to in the chat is working along with me here, and so they're going to match, or they're going to tell me now what the match at the end of the input string is. You know, just to put it right at the end, and I'll give them a second to do that. They're going to come up with it. I'm pretty sure it's going to be dollar sign. So we'll see who gets that first. So those are some special things that match it. And then you can also group things. Yeah, Mock Turtle got it. Good job. Okay. So there's also grouping characters. You group characters by putting them in between square brackets. So that means if you used an open square bracket, ABC, close square bracket, that means match any of A, B, or C. So anything you put in square brackets is any of those characters. And if you put a dash between it, so open square bracket, A dash, and for the Canadians you would say Z, or the Americans are going to say Z, A dash Z, close square bracket, that means match any character in ASCII order between A and Z. And if you put a caret at the beginning of the string inside the square brackets, that means that's a logical negation, so it's not. So open square bracket, caret, ABC, close square bracket would be match anything except A, B, and C. And so there's a bunch more, you know, this is just sort of scratching the surface of what you can do with regular expressions. And I encourage you to spend just a little bit of time looking at it, because They're really quite handy and really not very complicated to figure out. We'll put some links in the show notes to basically the references that I just pretty much quoted verbatim from, since I really don't know anything myself. I only know what's on the internet, so I'll tell you where I got this from. The most interesting one that I found was a website called www.regular-expressions.info. So there's a whole domain dedicated to regular expressions. And it really, you can get some awesome Greek or geek cred by just quoting regular expressions and throw them around a little bit, especially the completely unintelligible ones. So that's regular expressions. So I wanted to talk about that because what I really am wanting to talk about is GREP. So GREP stands for Global Regular Expression Print. And a bunch of resources online. The simplest for a Linux user probably is to just type man grep, and it'll tell you all kinds of stuff. The grep command searches one or more input files for lines containing a match to a specified pattern, and you won't be surprised to learn that the pattern is a regular expression. So by default, grep just prints the matching lines out, right? So it goes in and looks in the input file and prints all the lines out of the input file that have a match to that pattern. If you don't give it an input file, and I'll come back to this in a minute, if you don't give it an input file on the command line, then it searches its standard input. And that turns out to be very, very useful because the Linux or the Unix way of building things is to build simple little filters that take all their input from standard input and write all their stuff to standard output. And so what that means is that I can take the output from one program and pipe it using the vertical bar character through another utility. And so grep is a great second utility. I can take the output of something and pipe it through grep and have it look for something. And I'll give you some examples of where I use this real commonly. But let me come back to grep for a minute. And we'll just talk about there's a whole boatload of options that you can get off the man page and out of these tutorials about how to use it. There are a couple that are kind of maybe more useful than others. So let me just touch on those. The detail ones you can get out of the man page. Minus H, so the option minus H, you use because when you search for more than one file at a time, or if you put more than one file at a time on the command line, then the results that you get will show you at the beginning of the line what the name of the file that this string was in. So sometimes that's what you want. Sometimes, particularly if you're going to pipe the output from grep into something else, you don't want all those file names in there. And so the minus H command turns that off, turns off the feature. And this is a minus lowercase h. So if you use the option minus N, and so let me back up for a minute because I forgot something. The overall grep command syntax is you type grep, then the options, then the pattern, and then one or more file names. And so the options are dash H, dash N will precede each line with the line number in the file that it found that string on. And so if you're searching through a big file, that tells you which line number it's on. Dash I, lowercase I, tells grep to ignore the case. So it'll match both upper and lowercase characters the same equally well in the string. And so if you're digging output out of another Linux command, sometimes you don't know is it uppercase or lowercase. And so if you use minus I, it matches them both. Minus L displays a list of the files that contain that string. So if you're looking through a whole pile of files on your directory and you only want to know, well, which ones have this string in it, that's a great way to do that. It doesn't actually print the string, just prints how many, what the files are. And you can also search for whole words. So the pattern, as I said, is a regular expression. Now, it turns out that isn't quite enough. You got to tell it more about regular expressions. There's more kinds of regular expressions than I realized. There's basic, extended, and Perl ones. So mostly what we're interested in is GNU grep, because that's what's in Linux. And in that case, there's really no difference between the basic and extended syntax. But if you're a Perl programmer, there's a regex parser in Perl as well, and so it uses a slightly different syntax. Okay, so some common examples of ways to use grep on the command line day in, day out. Probably the single most common thing that I do with grep is I've run some program and it went away, I think, or I don't know. I'm not sure whether it's running or not. So on the command line, a really easy tool for figuring out what processes are currently running on your machine is the ps command. And ps has an option, dash capital A, that lists all of the tasks running on your system. Well, that's a lot of tasks on most Linux systems. There's a bunch of stuff running. And so if I wanted to know if Firefox was running, for example, I would type in ps-a, and then the pipe command, and then grep Firefox. And so now I'm not giving it a file name, because grep is looking for grep, then options, then the pattern, and then the file name. So I didn't put a file name in, and so grep just defaults to, it just reads it from its standard input, which then comes out of the standard output of the ps command. And so that's what that vertical bar, the pipe command, does, is it takes the output from ps, pipes it through grep. So if Firefox is running, then I'll get a line that shows me the Firefox PID. If it's not running, it just returns nothing. So another great use of grep is with the Linux dmesg command, dmesg, which is a way of dumping the kernel ring, or the messages that have come out of the kernel. So, for example, if I want to know about all the dmesg commands related to USB devices, then I could type dmesg, which is going to dump the kernel ring, the pipe command, and then I'm going to use grep-i, because I don't know exactly whether it's an uppercase or lowercase, and then the string USB. And Bill beat me to it. Yeah, he did a good job, guessed it right away. So dmesg pipe grep-i USB. And that dumps you out a list of all of the dmesg commands related to USB devices. Now, you still have to kind of sort through and find out what you want. But so here's another good one for so another good one to try, Bill, in the chat, is using a command line and the grep utility. How would you figure out how much RAM is available on a system? And it fits right in the middle of what we're looking at here with the dmesg command. So you guys can putz about a little bit to see if you can figure that out. So I'll get you started. So we're going to go dmesg, because there's information in the kernel ring about your memory. And we're going to pipe it through grep, of course, grep-i. And then if you type in the string memory, you'll get back a couple of lines that are not related, but you'll get back something that tells you how much memory is on the machine that you ran that on. So dmesg pipe grep-i memory. And you can also get it to show you serial ports, or just about anything related to, or about the different bits and pieces of what's going on in your overall kernel system. You can pipe them through grep and find them. It's also a good way to look through log files. If you've got some big log file and you're trying to look for something that happened with a particular process, grep's a good choice for doing that. So these are really simple kinds of ways of using the grep command directly typed into the command line. Little short things that you might conceivably set up as aliases. Like, I'm going to make one up, and I hadn't thought of doing this, but I do this so often. I'm going to make up an alias for ps-a pipe grep, because I'm forever looking to see, okay, you know, is this process running? And so I need a short way to do that. And so set up an alias that GPS is going to be equal to, quote, ps-a pipe grep, quote. And then I can just type GPS space Firefox, and it'll tell me if Firefox is running. So that's kind of a whirlwind intro to regular expressions, the basic and extended type, and to grep. So I'm going to throw it back in your ballpark here, Scott, if you're still with me, you're not sound asleep yet, and get you to tell us all about, what was it you were going to talk about? Sed and awk, yeah.
Yeah, so the first thing we're going to talk about is sed. And, you know, first I figured we'd start with sort of what it is. Sed is actually a stream editor. So this, I think, is, I think I got this either out of Wikipedia or out of the new GNU Sed manual. And we'll have links to both the GNU Sed manual and the GNU awk manual in the show notes. Those are great ebooks, basically, that you can go and check out. So anyway, Sed's a stream editor. It is a Unix utility that parses text and implements a programming language that you can apply transformations to such text. It reads inputs line by line, sequentially, applying the operation which has been specified via the command line or Sed script, and then outputs the line. It was developed in 1973 as a Unix utility by Lee McMahon of Bell Labs, and it's still available today for most operating systems. So Sed has its roots in the line editor ed and was actually sort of an extension of that, was sort of developed to be an extension of that. And it works by you specify a pattern to match, typically a regex. And then what it does is once it matches that, you also supply it a procedure or action to perform when it finds that match. There's a couple ways you can invoke it. You can either invoke it on the command line or through a script. So you can take either way. In fact, as Rob was talking about, sort of grep one-liners, there are a ton of sed one-liners, and I would recommend that if you're interested, go Google just sed, S-E-D one-liners, and you will find all sorts of things out there. So it's very useful for transforming text in a file or a series of files. So when I say transforming, you can do things like substitution and deletion and injection of text, things like that. And so perhaps the most common use is substitution. People do this all the time. And the way you would do that is you do you invoke it at the command line. You can do sed space and then a lowercase s, a forward slash. Then you specify the pattern you want to match. Then you put another forward slash in and the pattern that you want to replace that, the matched pattern with. And then another forward slash and then a space and then what the input file. So sed acts on files. It acts on text files. So you have to have an input file. You can use sed in a piped fashion as well. And we'll get to that in just a bit as Rob was speaking about grep. But typically you would give it an input file. Another common usage for sed is printing. You can print. One way that people use this is to print specific line numbers of a given file. And so you can do sed and then dash n, then the line number and p immediately after the line number, and that'll print the single line that corresponds to whatever line number you gave it. So for example, you could print line 50, you would just do sed space dash n space 50p, and it would print line 50. The n actually suppresses the default output of all lines, which is what sed will do without lacking the dash n. It'll output all lines in the file. But when you put that in there, you suppress that, and it just outputs the one. It just outputs the line that matches the pattern that you specified. Sed can also output a range of lines in a file. So if you wanted lines, say 1 through 10, you would do sed space dash n space 1 comma 10p, and that would print those range lines. And we'll see this in just a second when we get down to the case study. So as we talked about, sed actually directs its output by default. It directs its output to standard out. So if you are looking at a text, if you have a text file and you run a sed command against it, standard out is obviously your screen. It's going to flash by inside of your terminal window. But you can capture that, and a lot of people do this. You can capture it to a new file, an output file or a temp file, or even just a new file by using either the greater than or double greater than to append it to a file that you have out there. You can also use the dash I switch, and this is in newer versions of sed. And when we say newer, we're talking only 15 years old versus 30 years old. But in newer versions, you can use the dash I switch to do in-place editing, which will actually change the target file or the input file itself. So earlier in the chat, Mock Turtle had actually thrown out a question. I'm going to see if I can find it here, where he had said, here it is. Geez, now I'm going to not be able to find it. He asked if, Mock Turtle, where is your question? See, I should have found this earlier. Basically, the way that sed works is it goes into a text file. If you have six lines in that text file, it goes and it grabs the first line and it puts it into a buffer. And it looks at that line, and if in fact any of the patterns in that match the pattern that you've specified, it executes the action that you've specified to go ahead and execute. Now, you can specify multiple actions if you want, and what it does is it acts on each of those sequentially. So if you told it to, you know, substitute all S's in that line for D's, and then you told it to substitute all D's in that lines for E's, it's going to do those sequentially. And when you're done, you're not going to have either D's or S's in that line. They're all going to be E's. So if you have multiple commands that you want to execute in that fashion, you can. You use the dash E command to do that. You can also pipe the output of one sed command to yet another sed command. And you'll see that later when we get into the case study. That's how I actually went about doing it. And you can execute those on the entire file versus just on a single line. If you specify multiple commands using the dash E, it will do all of those on each individual line as it works its way through the file.
So that's Mock Turtle's question in the chat there. He's got it.
Yeah, it took me a while to find it, but I had it. I remembered what he had said.
Ah, good.
So there's a bunch. I'm going to just really quickly touch on. There's a bunch of things that sed can do. They have a bunch of commands that allow you to delete, append, insert text. You can do listing. You can print file numbers, and you can do a whole lot more. And we'll have a link or two to some of these sed one-liners. But I want to move on to awk, and then I want to get onto the case study. So I'm moving a little quickly here, but this is one of those ones where we just want to whet your appetite, give you an idea of some of the things you can do, and then leave it up to you to go off and pursue it, and if that's something that interests you. So awk, as has been stated before, is more than a utility. It's actually a full functioning program language. But so what is awk? The basic function of awk is to search files for lines or other units of text that contain certain patterns. When a line matches one of the patterns, awk performs specified actions on that line, and awk keeps processing input lines in this way until it reaches the end of the input file. Sounds a little bit like sed, but there are important differences here. So first off, let's talk about a little bit of history. The name awk comes from the initials of its designers, Alfred A. Ho, Peter Weinberger, and Brian Kernighan. It was originally written back in 1977 at Bell Laboratories yet again. So many good things came out of Bell Laboratories. It's in 1985, a new version was made, which they called new awk. That was more powerful, introduced more user-defined functions, multiple input streams, and computer regular expressions, a lot of advanced topics that we're not going to get into. Paul Rubin wrote the GNU implementation, GOK, or GOK, in 1986. Jay Fenlison completed it with advice from Richard Stallman. John Woods contributed part of the code as well. And in 1988 and 1999, David Truman and Arnold Robbins thoroughly reworked GOK, or GOK, for compatibility with the newer version of awk. Current development just focuses mainly on bug fixes, performance improvements, standard compliance, and the occasional new features. In 1997, Jürgen Kars felt the need to for network access from awk, and he worked with Robbins to set about adding features to do this for GOK. At the same time, he wrote the bulk of the TCP/IP internet working with GOK, a separate, and his code finally became part of the main GOK or GOK distribution with version 3.1. If you look at, well, I looked at a Mint Mate machine, a Mint 14 Mate machine, and on there, if awk itself is actually just a symbolic link to GNU awk or GOK version 4.0.1. So, and for simplicity's sake from here on out, I'm just going to refer to it as awk instead of GOK or anything like that. So here's a little quote from one of the developers, the original developers, Alfred A. Ho. He said, awk is a programming language for processing text files. A file is treated as a sequence of records, and by default, each line is a record. So again, sounds a little bit like sed, but here's the difference. Each line is broken up into a sequence of fields. So we can think of the first word in a line as the first field, the second word as the second field, and so on. An awk program is a sequence of pattern action statements. Awk reads the input a line at a time, a line is scanned for a pattern in the program, and for each pattern that it matches, the associated action is executed. So therein was the big difference. The fact that awk is able to break up lines by words. You specify some delimiter, and by default, the delimiter is white space or a space or a tab. You specify that delimiter, or you don't specify, and it just takes the default of space. And in between that delimiter, each one of those words or whatever it happens to be, could be numbers, could be anything like that, could be symbols, becomes its own field and can be referred to and manipulated and processed in a particular way. And this is just a small piece of what awk is, but this is what a lot of people use it for. So again, like I said, you can specify whatever you want for your delimiter, and you use the dash capital F to do that. So if you, we'll see this later when I get into the case study. So like I said, awk can be used, can print, and a lot of people use it for this. You can use it print using the following syntax. And so awk's a little more cumbersome. We talked about line number and P for sed. For awk, you have to do, you call it awk, and then you have to have a space and a single quote, and then a curly bracket, print, and then you can use $0, which is, it refers to the entire file, and then you got to close curly bracket and single quote, and then your input file, and it'll print the entire input file. Where it gets interesting is we talked about it being able to, in essence, tokenize the different words in that line, in each line in a file. So you can do things like print the first and fourth field in an input file. And this can become interesting when you have structured data in that file, and you want to just, like I say, you want to grab the first and fourth field, and you would do that by going print $1, $4. And as you can see a pattern here where the dollar signs refer to each field in that line. And what awk would do is it would go right through the whole file, and every single line that it recognized, it would print that first and fourth field. So awk can be leveraged in a bunch of other ways. Some of those ways, some of the things that people can do are things like add line numbers to a file or files, double or triple space a file that isn't triple space and these are all in one line commands that you can do this. Print the total number of words in a file, convert Unix new lines to DOS and vice versa, delete trailing white space from the end of a line, add spaces or tabs to the beginning of a line, align text to the left, right, or center of a line. And this can be for every line in the file. You can specify it can be for one or more lines in a file. It's up to you what you're interested in there. You can do find and replace, and this is similar to sed. And then it can also emulate the behavior of the head command, tail command, the unique command, and grep, and others. So you can do grep-like functions right inside of awk. So, and these are just, this is just using it as a utility. There are actually, it's actually a full-fledged programming language. And one of the reasons that it was extended in the first place was after it was written, the original developers went back and looked like, you know, 5-10 years on and saw what people were doing. And people were actually writing full-fledged programs in awk. And that's when it was decided, well, we need to give it more functionality. And that's why you have these different versions that came out. So I want to talk a little bit about the case study. So as I was thinking through, you know, what's a practical application for these utilities, for the three utilities? How can I use them to actually accomplish something? And so I started thinking through. If you guys recall last week, we talked a little bit about Update 6 for LMDE, and we were sort of like, geez, what did that actually apply to our boxes? Well, I don't know. I thought we were going to get Nemo. You know, you may recall the conversation. And so I thought, well, you know what would be good would be to take a look and see if we can use grep, sed, and awk to manipulate and massage the data in the bar log apt history file and have it presented in a manner which is easier to consume and, you know, sort of identify exactly what came in that particular update. So with any kind of scripting and programming, there's about 20 ways to skin the cat. I chose this particular method. Even as I look at this now, as I reviewed it this morning, I recognize that there are different ways of doing things. And, you know, you guys may have different opinions. I see Bill and I in the chat room is saying that I could just use sed to substitute Nemo for Nautilus, and that would probably get it done. But so anyways, I'm going to talk through sort of how I went about this and what I decided to do. So if you go in and look at that history file, one of the things they do is they use a single line to put all the packages that were updated in a given update session. So when I applied update pack six, there were two different things that happened. One, there was stuff that was installed, and that is specified on its own line. And then there was stuff that was updated, and that was specified on its own line. So in those two lines, 840 packages were listed. And so how do I extract those two lines to get them in a fashion that is easier to consume than the way they are in that file? It's really difficult to look through that file if you just throw it in a text editor and try and do that. So I did a couple of things. First I went in and I ran a command that would help me. I used an awk command that will tell me how many lines there are in the file itself. And this is one of the things that awk allows you to do is you can specify, you have your pattern matching that we talked about, and then it'll take certain actions based on that. But you can also specify what they call a begin or an end command. And that basically just tells awk what to do prior to or after it does all its matching in the file. And so if you run a command called end, and then in curly brackets, you've got print and capital N, capital R, and then give it an input file like the history log, it'll tell you how many lines there are in that file. And you can also add line numbers. We talked about this before. And so what I ended up doing is I ended up capturing how many lines there were actually in that file, and adding line numbers to them and putting that into a temporary file that I called my numhistory.log, and went in there to look to see what actual lines the update pack 6 had written in there so that I could reference those line numbers later. You can also do this. You could use grep if you wanted to. If you go in, if you grep your history log right now and just put in start date, it'll help you to identify which lines actually cover the update you're looking for. You could just grep, like I said, grep dash n start date, and it'll give you the line number that start date is actually on. And I was able to look through those and see, oh yeah, I did that January 6th. There it is. So I know based on the structure of the file, two lines down from there is going to be the way that the file is written. They have start date, then they have the command, and then they have installed, upgraded, and sometimes removed if they actually remove stuff. So part of what I needed to do was understand the structure of that file. But once I had that, I was able to extract the lines that I wanted. And for me, I wanted lines 124 and 125. Those had the installed programs and the upgraded programs for update 6. So I extracted those and dumped them into a temporary file. And from that temporary file, I went in there and was able to print the line. Well, I take that back, because what I actually did, that was one of the ways of getting that information out. But what I ended up doing is once I knew the lines that I wanted, I just wrote them out to their own individual files, because the data is structured slightly differently for installed versus upgraded. So I dumped one into an install log and one into an upgrade log, and was able to go back and run sed commands against those to create a listing. So now they're vertically listed. Each package is on its own line. And in there, it contains the package name, the architecture, if it's an upgrade, it shows the old version, then the new version, and that was it. And then I appended the word upgraded to the upgraded ones, and this will be clear in a second why I did this, and the word installed to the installed ones. Then I did some more massaging using sed to actually, well, using awk first, because I said anything that says upgraded, I want you to do this type of massaging. Anything that says installed, I want you to do this, because the data is structured slightly differently, and was able to get those kicked out into this list, comma separated. So each line, each data point, each field was now comma separated. And taking all that, I dumped it, I created a file, I sorted them so that they were alphabetically arranged, and were able to dump them out. Using awk, I was able to print them, pipe them through the sort command, and dump that out into a file that had a CSV extension to it, which I then was able to open inside of LibreOffice Calc. And so right now I'm looking at a spreadsheet that shows me on the far left-hand column is the actual package. Then I have the architecture, AMD 64 or i386. Then I have the old package name, the new old package version, new package version, and then in the far column is whether it was upgraded or installed. Now, there were some tricks to this because installed packages don't have an old version. And so I actually had to create a blank field, and then I had to reverse, I had to reverse the printing of the installs so that they would match, so that the old field would line up with this blank field. So when I put headers on this spreadsheet, everything in the new version will reflect what's actually on my machine. But now in a spreadsheet, it makes it so much easier. I can do all sorts of searching. It's very logical and intuitive as to what's here. I can look down and see that, in fact, Nemo, as we talked about, was installed. I now have I have version 1.1.2 plus LMDE. And it also installed Nemo-data and Nemo-file roller. So, in fact, that is on my machine. Other things that I could see right off the bat was that the Cinnamon desktop was upgraded to version, it's in here somewhere, if I can only spell, version 1.6.7 plus LMDE is the version that's actually on there, and that's upgraded. Now, that was just, I mean, this took me a little while because my scripting skills were a little rusty, and I used an iterative process to try and figure it out. But what it actually did, and mainly what I've used in here, in fact, 99% of this script is sed commands piped into, or awk, starting with awk commands, piped into sed commands, piped into additional sed commands, piped into additional sed commands. And as I talked about in answer to Mock Turtle's question, where that benefited me was if I put multiple sed expressions on a given line or sed commands on a given line, I wouldn't have gotten the output that I was looking for. But by piping the output of one sed operation into yet another one, I could continually massage that data, clean up things like I had to remove semicolons, I had to remove parens, I had to substitute commas in where there were white space, things like that. And I was able to do that all. It's funny because the script is only 8 lines in the end. 8 lines was able to take, and when I invoke it, I just give it the line numbers that I want. Originally, I had hard-coded the line numbers in, but I can use this again in the future. All I have to do is give it, you take a quick look at the file, figure out what line numbers I want, give it those line numbers, and boom, it'll work again. Now, one thing I did run into is sometimes on different systems, and this happened on the Mate system, and in fact, my Cinnamon system kicked a font error when trying to open LibreOffice. It doesn't necessarily like the font. And I haven't dug deep enough to understand why it's doing this, but on my Mate box at work, my VM machine there, it actually kicked out Chinese characters into Calc. And so it wasn't actually legible, but the CSV file actually had the structure that I wanted. I could go back and clean all those files up, but I left them so for debugging purposes, and the CSV file had the proper syntax and the proper data structure that I was looking for. Something about the font wasn't supported in LibreOffice. But again, the reason I did this case study was just to think about, okay, how can we use these? What's a practical, reasonable, real-world situation where we wanted to do, you know, where we could use these sed, awk, and grep and accomplish something that made sense and actually served a purpose. And so that's what I came up with. And I thought it was, it's just like anything else. This script could use all sorts of work to be cleaned up and be better. Every time I look at it, I go, well, I could prompt the user for input, or I should clean up those temp files, or I should do this, that, or the other thing, or I should, you know, make it portable, or, for now, it does exactly what it's supposed to do. And it really, to me, it just shows the value of using these. And this is, again, just at a very high level. There's so much more you can do with sed, awk, and grep.
Yeah, that's the thing that struck me looking at this as well, is this, the knowledge scalability, if you will. You know, it goes all the way from the simple little one-liner, half-liner, looking to see if a particular process is running, to something as complex as a multi-line script that's doing a lot of text manipulation to find information in a log file to stuff that's even beyond that, in the sense of, you know, looking that some of the examples I looked at, they were looking for particular patterns and word counts in these large language corpora for natural language processing, you know, pulling out the Gutenberg project and finding how many times does the word the occur, and doing stuff like that, all of which is possible with these utilities. So there's really an amazing amount of range to the things that you can do with them.
And the crazy thing is these were developed 30 years ago, 35 years ago. It's just nuts.
And developed to be relatively simple text processing tools.
Yes.
You know, not this is not a word processor.
No.
Now, they have grown into things that are considerably more complex or allow much more complex behavior. But amazing.
Don't try and use these on your doc files, because they won't work. Or your ODF, your ODF files, they will not work.
Unless you can type really funny characters. Or I'll bet, but you can. Those are compressed XML files, I think, aren't they? So I'll bet you could unzip them and then dump them through these utilities and strip the XML out.
It'll let somebody who has much better scripting skills than I take a run at that. Yeah.
That's left as an exercise for the listeners. Send us in, let us know how you made out with all that.
Absolutely.
We'll be sure to post it.
Yep.
So, Scott, the script that you wrote, is this open source software? Are you going to put this in the license it under
I'm going to see if I can make some money
GPL.
On it.
Sell it. You're going to keep it closed source and go commercial on us.
If our listeners are interested, I'll put it somewhere. It really isn't anything impressive in the end. I'm just glad it worked. I am a quick and emphasis on dirty scripter. My scripts are usually pretty ugly.
Well, that's kind of a definition of scripting, is it's intended for exactly that purpose, right? It's used for much more than that, of course, but I think it was originally intended for short little...
Solve the problem.
10-liner problem solver things.
Yep, solve the problem, doesn't have to be beautiful. So.
Right, because you're going to throw it away afterwards and write it again next time.
Very likely.
Yep. Well, very interesting. So I'd be interested to hear from listeners on kind of the ways that have used these three tools. We've got a bunch of feedback from the guys who are in the chat tonight, who, I have to say, turn out to be an amazingly well-informed bunch of Linux geeks. I had trouble getting my explanation out before somebody had the command typed into the chat. So kudos to the guys that are in there tonight. You guys rock.
And I guess we'd be interested in feedback. You know, this is probably one of the most technical podcasts that we've done in a while in terms of delving into a subject like that. And if this is something people are interested in, I've used SEDNOC before and I used it in a similar fashion, but I did a lot of research in terms of trying to make sure I was fresh on it for this particular podcast. We're willing to do this kind of stuff, but we need to understand if people like that or if they want us to keep it at a higher level. Give us some feedback if you would.
That would be great. So I think that's going to close us for our main topic then. And so we'll move on into getting a little feedback, which we've got a lot. So first up are some web comments. So coming in from Brian36 in Dorset, UK. Almost messed that up. Dorset, UK. Thanks, guys. Especially the Mint XFCE review and Rob persisting and looking for things to talk about it. I would miss the Mint menu. My preference is Mate, but will now certainly try out Mint XFCE. Well, I'm still using it and haven't really missed... Well, maybe I missed the Mint menu a little bit, maybe. So, yeah, anyway.
All right. So our next comment comes from John A., who wrote in response to my comments last week about my recently purchased Roku. And he writes in and says, Roku, why do you hate freedom? Should have gotten a Boxy instead. And he gives the link to the Boxy TV site. And he continues on, true, some elements of the UI are proprietary, but Boxy is actually just an XBMC front end and by consequence almost infinitely extensible and customizable. By supporting Boxy, you are supporting open source home theater PCs, which are actually well established. There are dozens of articles on mainstream sources such as Lifehacker about them, and commercial companies have been founded around this software. OpenELEC, or OpenELEC, and Linux MCE are also interesting projects, the former being a more complete XBMC that ships with a PVR included, and the latter being a front end for Myth TV that comes with great customizability with accessories and a focus on home automation. Oh well, don't return it just yet. 79 of your hard-earned dollars probably mean something to you. So I wrote back, and I had actually looked into Boxy prior to the purchase. I wrote back and said, John, after reading this review, and I'll have a link to this review of Boxy TV, I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. You guys are going to need to go out and read the review if you're interested. It's fairly harsh on the Boxy TV. There's another review that was actually written by Rothgar, who is a former host of this show. Longtime listeners will recognize that name. And Rothgar wrote one that isn't as harsh as the first, but it would not influence me to look any closer at the device. His also points out some of the flaws. And some of the flaws you see with Boxy TV, one, you know, we talk about, or John talks about supporting open source home theater PCs, but actually Boxy TV is made in a huge partner in the Boxy TV project is Walmart. So I personally am not huge on supporting Walmart. They get all the support they need, as far as I'm concerned. You will see, if you go into a Walmart and go into their section where they have their electronics, you will see stacks and stacks of Boxy TV. Not to spoil the review, maybe tease it a little bit, but one of the things that the first review does is really point out how the Boxy TV at this point in time is really beta hardware. And they're looking for people to test it while they figure out and get firmware updates out there. And personally, I'm not interested in that. I think the Roku is a lot more mature. Rob, you and I have talked about this many times. I definitely support things around open source and the goals and ideas behind open source, but I'm also somewhat pragmatic, and I'm going to make an investment in what works. Now, at the same time, as we talked about in the introduction, I did get my Raspberry Pi working with RaspBMC, and
which is another possibility. Yeah,
yeah, I'm pretty excited to push that project along. But John, thanks for writing in, and if folks are interested, go out and check those three links, both to Boxy TV and the two reviews.
Abiza writes in and says, in episode 143, you were speculating on the state of IT education in UK schools, with particular reference to the Raspberry Pi. Here in the UK, IT lessons consist mainly of learning to use MS Office. In terms of learning about programming or how computers actually work, there is very little. Even access is largely overlooked. My daughter's school is unusually well-funded, and they now have some Macs and iPads, as well as the usual Windows PCs. I've spoken to IT teachers at the school who have barely heard of Linux and know little about software engineering. While I despair of where the country is going to get its next generation of IT professionals, there's a glimmer of hope in school IT clubs. This is the only place in my experience where the Raspberry Pi is having any sort of impact in British secondary school education. However, the kids who attend these clubs are self-starters who may already have a knowledge of IT which exceeds that of their teachers. I accept that, taking the country as a whole, there must be many IT teachers who do have a thorough grounding in software development. Well, they are the ones who will try and inspire students with a Raspberry Pi. However, all the while, the national curriculum does nothing to encourage them. Their scope to have an impact is limited. And yet, I have to say, I really don't know much about the uptake of things like the Pi or other things like that in U.S. schools. It just strikes me as being the kind of thing that would be a bit more complex than most schools that I know of would be willing to take on, just because they don't have the IT resources to support them. So, but appreciate all those comments on the web. One in from Ian Simpson on email now. who says, I'd like to support Rob in his praise for XFCE. I've been using XFCE very happily on my LMDE system for over a year now, having tried Cinnamon and Mate briefly and having had a few problems. I've recently installed Update Pack 6 with no real problems. In view of the sad news but regarding the end of official XFCE support in LMDE, I decided to try Cinnamon again. No doubt that it's one of the nicest looking desktops around, but after trying for some time to duplicate my XFCE setup, that being twin monitors with panels on the right-hand screen, window buttons on the top and launchers, date, etc. on the bottom, I gave up and restored XFCE as my desktop. Maybe in the future I'll look at the proposed unofficial LMDE XFCE, and he gives a link to the Linux Mint forums where they're talking about that. If I want to install from a new ISO, or maybe I'll just try and install XFCE 4.10 in place of Cinnamon. So in the interest of time, I'm going to not read the whole thing. And wanted to talk, there was something I wanted to pick up at the end of this. Item on the Raspberry Pi was interesting. He says, I've just demonstrated an information display system at my golf club using the Screenly package. And he gives that gives a link to that, which we'll put in the show notes as well. He says, at a cost of a few pounds or slightly more dollars, we can display notices on the TV screen in the bar when it isn't showing Europe winning the Ryder Cup. Images and web pages can be easily displayed and controlled from a browser in the secretary's office. So another good example of places where these little single board computers are starting to show up. And he says, anyway, keep up the good work, Ian Simpson. He says, P.S., hope the spelling is better this time. Got a fresh dictionary. So I hadn't noticed the spelling last time he wrote in myself. But
yeah, I thought it was a good example of working a little anti-U.S. slam in there with the Ryder Cup comment, but
the Ryder Cup, yeah. Well, he did say grin, so I guess we can cut him some slack.
Hey, they did win it. They deserve it, and the U.S. yeah, folded so entirely in that, but that's sort of old news, though.
Yeah.
What have you won for me lately?
Exactly.
All right, so you guys may recall that Tony wrote in last week and gave us a hard time about our lack of love for KDE. So I asked him right back if he had a chance to listen to podcast 143, and he actually did. So he wrote in and said, thanks for that, Scott. I was pleasantly surprised to hear on episode 143 and the positive slant that you put on the Mint edition of KDE 4. Hopefully more people will try KDE because of your review. Not with you on the dislike of the cartoony icons in the KDE, in the default KDE, but you are in good company with Linus Torvalds, who said something similar. The sharp little mouse icon that you prefer, I'm not keen on, but I do turn off the bouncing launch feedback. Each to their own, I guess. And that's, I recognize that that is absolutely my OCD self looking at that thing and having problems with it. And obviously a lot of people like it or it wouldn't be the default. He goes on to say, like you, I wasn't convinced by the need for KDE activities and took some time to try them out. I've since created several activities based on hobbies, work, and interests and find them semi-useful way to differentiate between tasks. I could, of course, manage perfectly well without them. One thing I find useful is to try out different wallpaper/plasma widgets on a separate activity before transferring a new look to my main desktop, and that's an interesting point there. All in all, I'm very happy with my setup of Mint KDE. It is, in my opinion, the most complete of the desktop environments and perfect for Windows refugees. That's not to say that it's all I use. I'm a big fan of CrunchBang. It appeals to my minimalist side. That's one of the great things about Linux, the power of choice. You don't get that with Windows or OS X, regards Tony. And then finally, we got, I think this is the last one, yeah. We got a note today from Robert Wooden, and I'm going to paraphrase a little bit. Robert wrote in to actually ask us why, what we had done to make the last podcast so quiet. Volume-wise, the output file, he had to turn it way up, and the headphones he uses at work, he can get to a maximum volume, and he could just barely hear the last one, the last episode, episode 143. So I wrote back to him today and said, that's my fault. I'll own this one. Rob's been doing most of the producing for the last little bit of time, and it was my turn to do some producing, and between the new system that we're using to record, the live stream, this jack-enabled box, my audio file was very loud. Rob's was very soft. I tried to meet in the middle, and I ended up downing them too much. And I think when I was editing, I had my speakers on too loud, so it sounded loud to me, but I realized that the output AUG and MP3 files were a little too soft. So I think I know where I went south, and the more production I do, the better that'll get. But I do apologize, and I appreciate people sticking with it and turning the volume up and listening. So
I think you should have to do all the production from now on, Scott, just as penance for doing this. What do you think? Is that fair?
Well, it's potential we'll just lose all our listening audience. So yeah, I don't know if that's totally fair. So
yeah, I think this is a constant battle for us because neither of us are audio professionals, and so it seems like. Every time I do either the first go to podcast or do the post-production work, I forget something or I'll do something wrong. And it's not like I haven't learned what to do, but it just, there's a lot of details to get this right. And my hat is really off to people who do this for a living.
And do it well. People are good at it.
Because it's just invisible to you.
Yep.
You know, you're sitting listening to the radio, or I'm watching TV, or I go to a show, and of course you can hear everything, and it just, you get immersed in the content, and you never think that in behind that is some absolute wizard who's adjusting the technology just so that you don't even know it's there. And it really, when you try and do it yourself, it's really remarkable how fiddly it is to get exactly right. So it
gives you more appreciation for things like the Academy Award for sound production and things like that.
You often think, well, what in the world are they getting an Academy for that for? Well, now I know. This is really complicated stuff.
You know, and
we don't do it real well, but we get it out okay maybe sometimes.
And this era was just as simple as me having my speakers up too loud. So it sounded good to me, but the speakers were up too loud. So anyways.
Yep. And Bill commented, the Audacity level is a good reference. And that really is true. I tend to use that more than the sound. Just I like to fill the waveform up on Audacity. And if it's all full, I figure, well,
that's got to be good. Yeah. Yeah.
Although you do listen, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and some of them you turn on and boy, they just kind of blow you into the next room. On the speakers, and the other one, I'm driving along in the car, and I got my car radio turned up to the maximum, and I can still barely hear them. So, we're not the only ones, I guess.
Well, anyway. We definitely appreciate the feedback too. I mean, to understand, you know, I kicked that thing out. I did listen to it, but when I listened to it, my speakers were up too loud, so it sounded good.
Yeah.
So when you give us that feedback, we understand, you know, what you guys are experiencing. Excuse me, and that's the important piece. So, is it okay if I handle the website and tip? Since I threw them in here?
Please do that, since you stuck them in there.
So, yeah, so what we have is we have a website and tip in one, and it's going to be, again, some links. And what we're going to be linking to is the GNU utilities for Win32 or the GNU Win site, which gives you the Unix utilities. And before you guys flame me for talking about Windows applications, which these are executables that you run on your Windows box, what they are is they're actually Windows ports of common GNU utilities. And the reason I put these in here is because I had installed these on my box some time ago. I'm forced, for those of us that are forced to use a Windows box at work, if you have the ability to install software on that box, if you're not locked down by the people you work for, these are a great thing to have on there. I actually use the Unix utilities, which is the second link, the GNU Win link that we'll have in there. And I just take these, it's a bunch of little executables, I throw them into my System32 folder, and now they're in my path, and I can do things like ls on my Windows box. I can do grep. I can do head, tail. Tail is one that I used all the time at work, particularly when I was traveling and doing work last year. I can do awk. It's not actually awk, it's gawk or gawk. There's no alias. I could probably set one up, but there's no one by default. Sed is in there. So now you have all these great utilities that were never specific. Some of them have been ported to Windows in other form or fashion, but most of them don't exist on the standard command line for Windows or even PowerShell. But now you have them. And so we're going to have links in there. I love these things. I use them all the time. And even in, like I say, in researching this episode, there were a couple times at lunch at work when I was sitting at my desk and I I cranked it up and started doing some GeoC work in Windows, which is just fantastic. I think it's a great way to leverage these things when you're in a situation where you don't have a Linux box available to you. So we're going to have the links in there. The GNU utilities for Win32, that one has actually been updated for, probably as recently as 2007, 2008, somewhere in there. The other one has probably not been updated for a while. And of course, these are only 32-bit versions, which is no big deal. They'll run on a 64-bit Windows install. But I would recommend that if you're in a situation like I am, go get these things, and then you can LS from a Windows command prompt.
You know, the only one of these kind of tools I've ever run across, I hadn't seen either of those, was the Cygwin stuff. And that's just really awkward to use for most stuff if you're sitting in a Windows environment. The tools are great, but it's really just a nuisance to have to fire it up and run it that way. So these are much better in the sense that they're native Win32 apps, and so you can just use them properly.
Yeah, and Cygwin's a sledgehammer in this particular case. And it's a big install, and Cygwin's pretty amazing little and maybe someday we'll do an episode on Cygwin, but because it's that big. But as Bill pointed out in the chat room, it's a PITA, and you can imagine what that stands for.
And so one of the things that Cygwin is, and the reason they did it the way they did, is because there's a lot of the multitasking and file management stuff that Windows just doesn't have. Do you run into any of those kinds of things, like T's and that sort of stuff that just don't work right?
I haven't used it that extensively. Like you say, one of the reasons, the first reason I got it was I needed tail. And I was looking for a Windows version of tail because I wanted to run a tail.-f, which shows you a file in progress as it's being written to on a log file on a Windows box. And there's no way to do this in Windows. And so running a tail-f, I needed that command. And so I ended up running across the Unix utilities.
To do that. So I've written, when I ran into things like that, and mine won't do that, but I wrote a tail command just in C# and compiled it. So I have a bunch of little tools like that. But they're not as well written as these ones would be, in the sense that it wouldn't do it on an open file.
Mm.
So, but some of those things are pretty easy to write on your own. But, well, head and tail are easy to write, but not the rest of them.
Yeah. So anyways, cool. We'll have links in the show notes to both of those.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a good one. I'll actually go look at that, I think. So our final final note tonight is an announcement that I think came in from Jonathan Nadeau, if I'm not
correct,
mistaken on this, about the 2013 Northeast Linux Fest. And so we'll put a link in the show notes to this, and they're looking for, or they're just announcing it coming up. What's the date? Tentative schedule. Do you know what the date actually is?
I'm looking for it. It's funny. I thought I had seen it, and they have a lot of stuff on the page here. March 16th and 17th. March 16th and 17th at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Would that be Harvard?
Harvard
University. Harvard University.
You're going to pack your cat and have it yet.
Yeah, so this is a bunch in a row that they've done too. This is obviously not their first time to the rodeo. They've done several of these, so
yep.
Well worth it if you're within driving or jumping or walking distance of the area. Drop in and see the folks at the Northeast GNU Linux Fest. And it promises to be a great time.
At the very least, go out and check their page and see if there's things on there that interest you.
Yeah, for sure. So I think that's going to do it for us tonight. We're out of announcements, out of news, out of topic, and way out of time. So hope you guys enjoyed it. And as Scott said, do let us know whether this is the kind of thing that we should try and do another one of, or don't ever do that to me again, or I'll stop listening.
Thanks.
Let us know.
Thanks, everybody.
See you later.
This has been another episode of Mintcast. The show notes for this episode are at www.mintcast.org. You can send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org or leave voicemail at +1-832-514-2278. That's 832-514-CAST. You can find more information on Linux Mint at www.linuxmint.com. You can follow both Mintcast and Linux Mint on Twitter at Mintcast and at Linux_Mint. Thanks to Mark Blasco and Oscar for the podcast music, and thanks for listening to this episode of Mintcast.